it puts the viewer into that place, and you're yeah, just cut words it right there. I sit up there getting ready to go on. And I was like, wait, where am I going? Yeah, just cut it right there.
Welcome back to Street PX, a street photography podcast where we deal with all things documentary, reportage, and, you know, as said, street.
Street photography, that's right, man.
It is episode 46, August 25, and we're about to jump right into this one, but we got some plugs to throw out, don't we?
Let's do it. Let's well, do it.
Of course, as always, I am Casper.
This is Jim Watkins.
And first and foremost, we want to say Film Week. We've gotten a lot of emails and talking with listeners of the show, and you guys have been looking forward to this, so I guess it's about time to finally do it, right?
Oh, can't wait to do it, man. I can't wait to get my hands on some film. You know, that HP5, man, I used to shoot all the time. Man.
HP5, huh?
Oh, yeah, that was my stuff right there. And that Tri-X 400, yeah.
As far as Film Week's concerned, we're going to be going, we're going to be aiming for September 18th through 24th. And there's not a ton going on, but the main focus is for our listeners out there, ourselves included, to, you know, show a little love to the analog camera, you know, focusing on, you know, putting the digital on the shelf for just a week and dusting off any old Canons, any old Minoltas that you might have, yep. Leicas for you lawyers and doctors out there. but also a photo walk, just like we did last year, that is film only, and we're going to try and do that there on the weekend of the 23rd and 24th. So keep an eye on the Street PX Lounge for any of those events. We'll throw out invitations, and wherever you are, it doesn't have to be just here in San Francisco, but wherever you are, get a group of people together and just hit the streets with some film.
That's going to be great, man. I can't wait. Can't wait.
And it's also a time when we're going to be doing a film-focused show. We've already been in talks with, and I'm going to go ahead and throw this out here, Nick Mayo of Nick Exposed on YouTube is going to be joining us there in September to come in and just chat analog film.
Cool.
Yep.
Cool.
And between now and then, if you have any questions you want to throw us or throw to Nick, definitely email us at contact@streetpx.com. Oh, and we cannot talk about film without bringing up our awesome sponsor, Glass Key Photo. That's San Francisco's premier go-to spot for all things analog film. You can actually find them now at their new location at 1230 Sutter Street. And actually, me and today's guest, when we were shooting downtown the other day, we went in to take a look, and I also filmed it. So if you want to walk through, you want to see what the store looks like now, go over to streetpx.com and look for our most recent blog post. You'll see that video. It's also the place that we're going to be kicking off our film walk or our photo walk for Film Week there in September. And, you know, if you need some camera repairs, need a new camera, or need some film that day, it'll already be ready. So they're open 7 days a week from 12 p.m. to 6 p.m. And a place that we definitely recommend to go and take a look at. Leica Store San Francisco has a wicked new exhibit going on right now with Jim Marshall, focusing on the jazz festival era. Mm-hmm. And that started on August 10th, but that's going to be running till October 7th. So if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, go and take a look. That's there on Bush Street.
That's right. Jim Marshall is a fantastic photographer of that era. You know, he captured all those music geniuses, the music giants of the era, man. It was fantastic. I saw the exhibit. Oh, loved it.
Yes.
Loved it.
What else? Oh, Photoville for you New York people over there. Last year, I actually visited this with Nima Taraji and Mike Lee. That's where I actually met Mike Lee first time.
Yeah.
Photoville is just this, I don't know how other way to put it, but it's a weird-ass event, exhibition, where they stack a ton of storage containers right under the Brooklyn Bridge or in the Brooklyn Bridge Park, and within are different little featured galleries with different artists or different categories or genres. You know? Mm-hmm. But when I went, I spent hours there, and Scala Natino, another friend of ours out of New York, he was there with me, and check that out. That's going from September 13th through the 24th. Jim, do you have something to say on
that? Just gonna listen up. I was gonna talk about the next thing up.
Yeah.
The Dark and Light exhibit, Jay Blakesburg. He's a rock and roll photographer, and we're gonna have an exhibit there November 9th at the Harvey Milk Photo Center. Mm-hmm. You gotta check this out. It's gonna be a big one. It's gonna be a big one. Hopefully a few of these rock and roll celebrities will show up. Don't know who, but then we may have some, because they're all friends of Jay Blakesburg. But this will be a great show. November 9th, opening reception, and it runs until January 6th of 2018.
Yeah, and they also have a secondary show going on at the McLaren Lodge.
That's right, over in
Golden Gate Park. So the other thing, the main thing I want to note about that is the way that they're printing.
That's right. Yeah,
metal prints. Float hang right on the wall. Mm-hmm. And for anybody that listened to our last show with Dave Christensen, he's the director over there at Harvey Milk Photo Center. We had brought up the fact they have a donation page where it's a lighting project, so they have beautiful lighting that they got from the DeYoung Museum that's just sitting in the wings waiting to be installed. And as everybody knows, you got to pay to play. And the Harvey Milk Photo Center is under the Parks and Rec, so government, which means cuts and not much money to play with. So if anybody out there wants to help, go take a look at harveymilkphotocenter.org and just click on donate, and you can give a few bucks, or a few philanthropists out there, they would be ever so in your favor for a nice big chunk of pushback.
That's right.
Yep. Man. Yep. So that's enough on the pluggings, but if you do enjoy our show, go take a look at Patreon, throw a little bit our way, helps us keep the mics hot. Or if you want to just to help us without not financially, share this show. There's going to be a post on our Facebook page. So go on Facebook and hit that old share button, get the voice, get the awareness out there on Street PX, right? So anyway, enough of all that bullshit. It's time to sit down with a friend of ours who you may remember from our live show at Street Photo. CJ was one of the finalists, and we pulled him in and out of the crowd. He was brave enough to come up and sit with us.
He's basically ambushed.
Yes, basically ambushed. But the good thing is he took that torch and just ran away.
That's right,
away.
Yeah.
Like me, I remember me and Renzi just sitting off to the side going, this is working. Let CJ just talk. This is working. But at that time, CJ only had like 15, 20 minutes with us, and we wanted to sit down with him and get a little bit more background on who he is as an artist, and plus he's got some kick-ass projects going on and some in the past that you need to check out. So anyway, above all, welcome CJ to Street PX.
Yeah, welcome to the show, so man.
I know we've been talking about this for a while.
Yes, we have.
Yeah. After you get a little taste of it, right?
Yeah, definitely.
So just kind of start out. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Where did you kind of grow up?
All right. Well, I kind of moved around a lot. Long story short, I guess. Born in L.A., moved to San Diego, moved up to Willits, which is about 2.5 hours north of here in the city. And then joined the Marine Corps after that. Then moved up to Oregon. And so Oregon was great. I took a lot of photos up there, but it was more, that's when like camera phones were just coming out. I didn't own like a camera or anything like that. But it was just more about like taking photos of me and my drunk friends at football games, and, pissing people off, let's get a photo. No, I want a drink.
It's called proof.
Yeah, exactly. Just trying to document these memories because I'm not going to remember them the next day.
Uh-huh.
I started out that way. And then, just kind of growing up, my dad used to take photos of all of us all the time, the family and stuff. And I hated it. I hated being in photos. I hated just like having to pose for them.
Yeah.
It was like the worst thing in the world.
Yeah.
As like a 10-year-old kid, you're just like, oh, God dang it, not again, mm-hmm. So I guess that wore off on me, and somehow, I don't even know how, just that transition sort of naturally occurred. So now I know how my friends knew how I felt or whatever.
Yeah. Were you poking a camera in their face?
Exactly. So, and then, life happens, you move around and stuff. Then I moved to here to San Francisco, and, San Francisco, that was back in 2010, and, just the city, it's just a city full of artists, unfortunately, that are being driven out now.
That's no lie.
But, yeah, so, we make do with what we have, and so now, living in the city, it's, or, you know, just the friends that I met here in the city. You know, a lot of them are musicians, a lot of them are artists. So, you know, you just kind of get inspired. So I kind of took up the camera, you know, I started, you know, on my way to work, you know, walking through the city, you know, you just see so many different kind of interesting things. Yeah, and so I would just always capture photos with my iPhone. You know, it's pretty shitty quality, but it is what it is. You know, it's more about the moment, you know, not about like the quality, I guess.
But the thing about this mobile phone is it's always with you.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I'm not one to condemn the whole mobile phone photography, you know, aspect, but it's true. It's sometimes we don't have our cameras or our batteries are dead.
Yeah.
Just whip the phone out and it's quick.
I'm just not there yet, man. No. Well, at one point I will be, but I'm not there yet.
We got to update past that iPhone like 4 or 5 you got rocking in that pocket.
Hey, man. It works for what I needed. Yeah. I do have to say I have seen some beautiful shots with iPhones. I've seen some of the stuff you've taken.
I've been shooting with the Pixel for a while, and to be honest, I've been using it a lot. Actually, I've got a mobile phone class coming up. So
there you go.
What can you do?
There you go.
But we
digress.
Yes, we do.
But so now, you know, the more I walk the city streets, the more I was walking to work, you know, the more I saw these like different opportunities, different moments, just people looking like in their own little world, because in the city, everybody's so concerned going from A to B, you know, nobody kind of hangs out unless they're, you know, on the phone or something. And still, they're kind of still in that limbo all the way to B, to their destination. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know, just I started observing this more and more and more, just these little moments that people were having. And I just started shooting because I thought, you know, people looked interesting.
Mm-hmm. And, some more interesting than others.
Exactly. Yeah, definitely. And so, I mean, I just started back in 2013. I got a nice camera and, you know, I went to a lot of different concerts as well, too. You know, friends, they work down at, you know, the rickshaw stop. So I was always getting access there and meeting the artists that were singing and whatnot. And so I really kind of homed in my photography skills at first during concert photography.
Okay.
You know, which was, you know, you have to be pretty quick, especially with all the changing lights and whatnot. Yeah. So I'd say it was really kind of like that was like my boot camp, I guess, in sort of a way. Uh-huh. You know, just kind of adjusting to all these super quick moments, you know, to get that right line and get that right photo as these lights are just flickering on and off. And the more I did that for about a year. And the more I did that, the more it, you know, the more I was able to take those skills, that quickness to the streets and really kind of... I don't know, how do you say it? Like maybe just kind of slingshot my camera in that direction and get a quick shot that was going to be gone forever.
You're able to react.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, kept doing that more and more and more and more. You know, I kept seeing, kept getting positive feedback from my work, you know, from friends, from different artists. You know, you should do this more. You should, you know, try that, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But I was like, all right. And so eventually, like when I first got my first real street photography camera,
what was that?
The X100S.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
It first came out. I tried to find it everywhere and I couldn't find it. So I called Portland, you know, like the Shutterbug up in Portland. And I was like, yeah, do you guys have one up there? They're like, yep. I'm like, hey, hold it. I'll be there tomorrow. I was literally on Fisherman's Wharf, just bored. Like, what am I going to do with my day? You know, and I called them up. They said that I was on a train that night. It was a Sunday. I was on a train that night at 9 p.m. heading up to Portland to get my first photography, you know, little mini compact camera, whatever. Uh-huh. And cruised up there, got there the next day, picked it up, shot around Oregon or Portland for a little bit. And I just fell in love with it. And, you know, it's kind of one of those things when you have that, you know, when... Not to be, whatever, but everything just starts clicking for you.
You know?
It's like, you know, you're meant to have this photo or this camera.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And it's just like definitely an extension of your arm.
Mm-hmm.
And, for me, you know, after a while of doing that, photography is like, you know, just, I have super crazy anxiety issues. So that's why I'm always on the streets, you know, and it's the only time that I really feel calm. You know, like
it's kind of like your safety safe.
Exactly. You know? Where I can, all my anxiety is like kind of like, oh, what's that? What's that? What's that? What's that? You know, so it's like, but in my mind, it's like my zen. You know?
Uh-huh.
It's
like where
I can center myself right there in the streets being, you know, looking left, right, behind me, up and down, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So people on the street may look at me like, who the hell is this guy? Uh-huh. But for me, in my mind, you know, it's, Yeah, it's a calming, therapeutic experience.
Good. The camera does work as a kind of a blockade. Mm-hmm. I got that same anxiety. I can relate to you fully. It really does matter for a lot of photographers out there.
Yeah, and I can imagine that helps you approach people. I mean, you can get the shot. You can get in there and get the shot if you have that, you know, that zen-like feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that quality. I do not possess that. I wish I could do that, you know.
Yeah, it's
got to force yourself.
Sometimes. Yeah, yeah, it's you just, do. You
I mean, we all have our you down do. Days, you know, yeah. where we feel burnt out and everything, but you know, I guess I just, like, on my burned out days, I force myself to get out there and I kind of think about the end result, you know, like, now I have to be out there. It's not like, do I want to go out? No, but it's like kind of like I have to, or else I'm going to die tomorrow. So, oh,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. I think we're all a lot yeah. of us shooters are just like that. You know,
that's what you run into when you have a passion for, be it a hobby or even a profession. Yeah, mm-hmm. as they say, you know, make your love your work, and you never work again.
Right, right.
You know, it's just mm-hmm. if you don't have that desire to just go out and just walk the streets and shoot, then you might not be in the right area.
That's true.
You know, if every day you wake up and you're like, I don't want to go, it might be time to look for another.
Yeah, I mean, you'll see it in the results.
Yeah, you will.
You just start taking shots just to take shots.
Yep.
You know, and you'll see it in the results. I mean, it'll be crap.
And that's the thing. Like, when I'm first, like, every day, like, when I go out and I'll just take a couple, like, just bullshit shots just to kind of warm myself
right.
up.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I do, yeah.
You mm-hmm. know, and then after that, you know, game on.
Yeah,
know? And
yeah.
But just with my work and everything, you know, I mean, it just, you'll see a lot of, like, kind of emotion in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
It's just a lot of emotion from people. And, you know, it's just the way that I'm feeling that day, or the way that I was feeling, or, you know, something that I want to get out of, you know, out of me, or whatever the case may be. You know, it's, so I kind of, my work is more based around emotion.
Mm-hmm. So you're trying to pull that kind of, that sentiment into it.
Exactly. Or, yeah.
Yeah. Well, now, coming off of street, and it's not to say that street's the only thing that you do. You actually have a really great you know, portfolio of documentary work to do. So that's something I want to talk about. Oh, actually, you know what? Before we jump into that, I was kind of curious. You said you were in Portland for a while.
Yep.
That where you went to school?
I went to Oregon State.
Oregon State.
Yeah, for 4 years there in Corvallis. So
art school?
Nope, I was an archaeologist.
Archaeologist?
What?
Yeah. I was getting to that.
Yeah, get to that.
You know, we're going to get to the documentary stuff shortly. Yeah. Let's go with archaeology, because that is...
Should I call you Indiana now?
I never had a whip, you know, or a gun. But
not yet.
Not yet. I got
maybe in the tenderloin.
Yeah, yeah.
That's true. So archaeology. Yeah. Wow. What kind of archaeology? Let's give a little insight here.
Just cultural archaeology. I mean,
so you're digging up bones, so, or
well, more or less. Like we would. I got into archaeology. Like I first got, I was in welding, you know, mm-hmm. at the community college here, and I'm like, you know, I don't want to do welding like this, you know. So, you know, I want to go to Oregon State. I don't want to keep coming back out to, you know, drive 10 miles to school every day. I just want to walk to school. So I applied to Oregon State, got in, and then, I first majored in history, and I'm like, what the fuck am I going to do with this? And so, you know, I was able to like combine history and, you know, being more physical myself.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, I took up archaeologist, anthropology and whatnot,
yeah.
and I really wanted to do underwater archaeology. That was like kind of my first love.
Uh-huh.
Cool, you know, and I did that for a little bit.
So you're looking for Atlantis, and what the hell?
You know, Atlantis, I was looking for, you know, just diving on World War II airplanes.
Yes. Uh-huh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know, it was fun. It was good stuff. Like, you know, we were up in the sound, the Puget Sound, and we were diving down there. And, I mean, this water was, you know... It was cold, the Puget Sound.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you have like 5 feet of visibility if you're lucky.
Uh-huh.
You know? But yeah. That's where I learned. But moving on from that, it was just, you know, it just really gave me a way to be out in the field, out in nature, being able to just kind of, you know, it's just kind of a peaceful experience for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just gotten out of the military, out of the Marine Corps. And so it was just really nice to be back in the field. It was nice to just kind of, you know, work with other you know, people that were kind of in the same thing. But I guess, like, I've always had that, like, kind of documentary passion and inspiration, whatever, inside of me. And mm-hmm. so within the last year, you know, I've kind of dived from, you know, more documentary work to than street photography.
Okay.
I still love street photography, don't get me wrong, you know.
Yeah. But, well, they're cousins. I mean, it's all under the same umbrella anyway.
Exactly. And so I have a schedule now where, you know, I work 4 days on, 3 days off, and I'm able to, like, just take these little mini trips to, you know, as far as I can go and come back, you know, mm-hmm. within those days. I just got back from Nevada, and I was working with my old fraternity brother out there. Like, I joined, like, this the cowboy fraternity, you know, the agricultural fraternity, yeah, if you can believe that. I'm very far from that. But, I've, like, got the most random resume.
Future Farmers of America. Seriously,
yes, definitely.
Yeah.
I was kind of like the brown sheep of the family. But, I went there.
Well, that's all right. That's why we got that big not safe for work.
Yeah, we go many places too. So right, go ahead.
But no, it was cool. It was cool. You know, I was working with one of my friends, Mark Lundy, out there. He let me come out to the Wine Cup Gamble Ranch. You know, just document their lifestyle. You know, he's a cowboy out there. Him and like four other guys, I really learned about like how they work on a ranch in the middle of nowhere and mm-hmm. you know, kind of what goes in and out of, you know, their daily jobs. I mean, they love their jobs. You know, they're on horses every single day. They're in the field every day doing what they love. So it's not even work for them.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's just like it's just another day of going out and shooting on the streets for us. You know,
yeah,
it's kind of like
yeah.
same thing for them. But
how big's the ranch that they were on? Do you know?
I think it's like 1.1 million acres or something. It's pretty big.
That's why I wanted to ask the question.
Yeah.
1.1 million acres.
Yeah, it's huge. It's huge. But so yeah, just kind of been diving into more documentary type work, and you know, it's just really, it's, you know, just kind of for me getting back to my roots. You know, kind of what I've. It kind of seems like it's what I've always wanted to do, but I never knew it,
mm-hmm.
sort of thing. And now that I'm there, you know, I'm just kind of taking off with it, and you know.
Yeah, I was trying to make this build this bridge between archaeology and photography,
mm-hmm.
and it seems like, you know, archaeology is all about telling the story of the past.
Yeah,
and this moving to documentary is the same thing, only that you're telling the story of the present. That's the bridge, telling a story. At least this may be a stretch.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way I see it with you. You know, it's like you want to tell a story, whether it's the past, you know, in digging up bones and artifacts,
mm-hmm.
or the present, you know. And you said you were into anthropology too?
Anthropology, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. See, and it's the same thing, telling the story of man.
Yeah, exactly. And just, you know, I was a forest archaeology in the Lhasa National Forest, and my job was literally just to walk in the forest every single day for, you know, miles on end, and just looking for, you know, artifacts on the ground, you know, 50-year-old mining sites, or, you know, Native American sites, you know, what have you. Whatever we came, you know, whatever we ran into, we would document. So, and it's kind of like the same thing with street photography. I just didn't have a camera on me. I had a GPS,
mm-hmm.
you know, but we're still looking for those hard-to-find artifacts and moments and whatnot.
But you know, this anthropology thing, it reminds me of the urban studies that our past guest Pedro Lanturion, he did the same thing. You were urban studies and how that related to, you know, street photography.
Yeah, he was
kind of
making a connection.
Yeah, he's making that connection. And urban
bridging
studies,
that gap, like you said a while ago.
And urban studies is anthropology.
Well, yeah. I mean, all of this that we're looking into and talking about is with street, with documentary, with reportage, any of it, it's a kind of study of the human condition.
That's right.
You know, that's at its base foundation.
Yeah, building a narrative. Mm-hmm. Building a narrative of the human condition. And that's what street photography is about, but especially documentary photography to me. That's the next step for me.
Yeah.
You know, I want to do what you do.
No reason why you can't, man.
Hey, you live and you die. It's what you do in between is where you have a
right.
decision.
Yeah, that's
live
right.
Live every day like you're going to die the next.
Yeah.
You know?
Uh-huh. Only here in America do we worry about work more than everything else.
That's, you just got
to
do it.
It's time to switch that up. Aren't we trying to shake things up anyway?
That's right. We are.
For better or for worse.
We are.
But as far as the project that you have going on, this kind of, to me, it seems like we were talking the other day when we were walking around. We met up over at Fisherman's Wharf.
Mm-hmm.
Took a little walk in a glass. Key Photo, by the way, our sponsor.
Yeah.
I'm probably going to put that plug in about right here. But we were talking about that sense of Americana,
Yeah.
Me and you and Joe Aguirre were kind of sitting there talking about the Americana and looking for small town America, as you put it. Mm-hmm. Now, this project that we've been kind of alluding to throughout this, do you have a name for it yet? Anything that somebody can search?
No, I mean, it's just kind of something that's just going to come to me in my sleep or, you know.
Just come look at my shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the name of it.
That's the working title, huh?
Yeah, yeah. It really entices people, you know?
Exactly.
Curiosity.
Perfect for PR. Yeah. That's a public announcement right there from Street PX.
Yeah.
But it is a sense of Americana and looking at small town America, seeing people who are not... You know, they're not city dwellers. They're not, you know, jumping on a BART. Life is a little bit slower in these areas. Mm-hmm. It reminds me a lot of where I grew up in Southern Illinois. It's farmland, you know. I remember looking at cornfields and wheat, as far as the eye can see. Where you're going is kind of more ranch style sounds.
Well, just that one was. I was in high school, you know, just the years that you learn about life and, you know, your most important years growing up. I lived in Willits, which is, you know, 2.5 hours north of here. It's only 5,000 people. You know, full of hippies and rednecks and stuff. So, you know, growing up, it was a boring town. I was a skater in high school. It was just very boring. There was nothing to do. But now that I'm, you know, I'm a photographer, and now that I go back up there all the time, I see that town has really opened up to me, and just kind of, it's so brand new for me. You know, all these different, you know, areas that I used to visit as a kid and stuff now become something really like kind of historical for me, you know, in my personal life.
And
so I go back there. Yeah, totally. And I mean, and now it's instead of like, oh, that's a barn, cool, whatever, you know, now I really see like the beauty in a lot of these different areas and whatnot. You know, it's really cool because a lot of the stuff is still there.
Yeah.
Or, you know, they're run down, but they're still there, you know, which makes even more, you know, kind of cooler and all that. But, yeah, Willits is it's a really big, inspiring little town for me, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking to do like a book about Willits, you know, about the area up there. And,
I'll throw a little love to the hometown.
Oh yeah, definitely. You know, I love. You know, it's just a good town. You know, full of little people or little people.
Little people,
not little people. Delete that.
No,
it's not little people. Damn it. It's like. Moments. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know.
Oh shit. Yeah, see, this is what happens. But but you're talking about people that are in, you know, they're not running through that daily grind, that 90-mile-an-hour grind.
Right. You know, and it's just, I'm not saying to take away that people living in cities and bigger towns are, you know, they're not real people or anything like that, but you get to these smaller towns and you know, they're just doing their everyday thing, and whether it's working at a small store, owning a little shop, you know, or
generational
being out the ramps, you know, it's I don't know. For me, it's just kind of like it's just a really good kind of place to be. To I don't even know how to say that. Just to kind of, you know, just to photograph and document.
Yeah.
And my favorite time of the year is, you know, 4th of July, where Willits. It's basically. It still has, like, the rodeo there. It still has the street fight. Well, we call it the street fight, but it's really a street dance. There's always somebody in the... it's kind of a historical thing. Everybody looks at the Kylie Daily police log. You know, the next day to see. Yeah, there's always that guy.
Everything and, has that guy.
Seen a lot of my friends in there, but... but, you know, it just kind of comes with the territory, and... We have the parade, but we have the rodeo for like 2 or 3 days, you know, and it's just a really cool way to where everybody comes back from wherever they live and we just all get together. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a really cool reunion every single year.
Yeah.
And then the parade, we lock down Main Street there and there's a parade for about a half a mile. And it's a, you know, just this, like I said, the small town Americana parade with the waving the flags, you know, with the little kids. And you just walk it, you see all your friends you grew up with. And, you know, you just see like little, you know, just the little, you know, the old school fire engines, you know, what have you, you know, you know, just a small town parade. And it's just, I don't know. It's just really cool. I love that feeling. I love being there.
Uh-huh.
I love being able to document that.
Yeah. This country is losing that too. You know,
that's
the thing that's kind of disappearing now. And it's a great thing to start documenting, you know,
that's what happens when populations explode.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and urban becomes more, you know, becomes more important. No, not necessarily more important, but it becomes more prominent.
You're prominent. Yeah, that's a better
more
word.
Prominent. Yeah. Yeah, you know, and you start to lose the Americana, the ranches, the small towns, and things like that.
Yeah, which is a good kind of reel back onto the project. You know, you're actually, as of recording this, you just released the third part of this project.
Yeah.
Now, before we get into it a little bit more, where can people find this so they're listening?
You could go to my website, which is clucerophotos.com, and it's clucerophotos.com. And just right at the top there, you can view all my work, but you can also just click on the word blog, and parts 1, 2, and 3 will come up for you right there.
Now, parts one, what is part one? Just explain part one, those.
Part one was basically me leaving the city and, going out to, right past Reno. I just started documenting. There was a really big lightning storm and I got out, slapped a bunch of stuff on my camera that I didn't even know what the hell I was doing. And somehow, some way I was able to capture this, lightning bolt. I've never shot lightning in my life, I just got a brand new filter. It was adjustable and I was just hoping for the best, but as luck would have it, though, or fate, whatever, I was able to get a cool shot out of it. And then the rest of the series for part one was just me, just traveling along Highway 80 all the way to Montello, which is northeastern Nevada, almost on the border. It's about 9 hours away, whatever, from the city here.
Okay.
So, I just would stop and go the whole way there, kind of capturing photos. Crashed in a McDonald's parking lot, woke up, got to Montello at 9 a.m, started shooting around. And, my friend, he wanted to meet up around noon. So I'm like, I got a couple hours to spare, but, what do you do?
Yeah.
Head to this only bar in town and start hanging out with the locals and talking to them, learning about the history and whatnot. And
hey, that's the best way to get in. Seriously.
The nicest people in the world just talking to me about just a history of like the area. Met Barbara, who owned the bar, met Jay, who he's like in my series. He's the older gentleman, super nice guy who was we talked about the military, about the Army, talked about the Marines when I was in.
He was a military guy too, right?
Yeah. He still carries his old Army uniform from Vietnam in his truck. And like I went out there and just got a couple photos and I just coincidentally saw that. And I walked in and, I'm like, hey, before I leave, I want to get a couple shots of you with your uniform. And nicest guy in the world, he's probably at the bar a little too much, but, it's a small town, 100 people. Who cares?
What else is there?
Exactly. I don't know. It was really cool talking, speaking with him and whatnot. And was able to go out got a couple shots with him in his uniform. I thought it turned out pretty well. He bought me a couple beers. It's just a really, really nice guy, And then, about 4 or 5 beers later, I headed out to the ranch and met up with my friend Mark and just kind of started shooting around.
This is the guy that you already knew, right?
So, just got out there. He introduced me to everybody and he was kind of teaching me about what they do, how they kind of... Somebody rides out to the field where all the horses are. They lead all the horses into the corral, into the ropes where all the... If you look at my work, you'll see all the horses lined up on the ropes in this little corral. And what they do is they'll... the cowboy will... I want to work with this horse. He'll... Mark will go ahead and rope that horse, bring it out for that cowboy, and then, whatever. They change their, the shoes or, they ride it the next day. Whatever they're going to do. Take it out to the field. And so that was really cool. I really found it interesting learning how to shoe a horse as well. I've never seen that before in my life.
Okay, but, yeah.
Did you do it while you were there?
I didn't do it. No. But, I was taking photos. But
be a limping horse afterward, right?
Yeah. It was interesting, And it's pretty, pretty hard work. You're giving a horse a freaking pedicure. It's... basically what you're doing.
They're called
farriers,
right? Or something. They're called farriers.
Farriers?
Yeah, that might be the people who do that.
Oh!
Because I've actually seen at Stanford, they had the barn, you know, the horse barn, and you could see these guys who are shoeing these horses, all this fire and smoke going on, and they're putting these shoes on these horses,
hot shoeing them,
it was fascinating.
I remember having horses when I was a kid, riding horses, and we had, you know, we didn't have no multi-million or a million acre ranch, but you know, we had a couple of kind of irritating horses that just hated each other. But.
Yeah, I was around horses too, you know.
Were you really?
Yeah, you know, follow my father to the track.
Oh,
that's man.
Champions, champions. Yes, the kind of horses that make you real poor or real rich. There's not really much gray area.
That's right. So the whole ranching, that was part two, or is that part two? Or is it still?
Yeah, part two is more about like the ranch, kind of documenting like experience. What they do, you know, every day and whatnot. I wish I could have stayed a little bit longer because I wanted to go out to the field with them.
How long did you get to be out there?
Okay.
Let's see. Well, I left, I think, on like a Monday around 3 p.m., got there the next day. Just stayed one. I was there one full day, and then the next day we went out. We just kind of hitched a trailer that he couldn't get earlier that morning because of the rains were coming in. Mm-hmm. Shot a few photos, and that's what part three is about. Is my just kind of going out to the ranch shooting. You know, we saw a lot of goats, like over 200 head of goats on the way there. I mean, just like a swarm of them. Just came out of nowhere.
They're flocking over the road, like you see in Europe.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so, I was really cool. And they're used, you know, to kind of keep the brush down, you know, and
yes.
fights. And
they have their purpose, absolutely. Yeah.
They were just telling me about the area, you know, which is, I mean, it's just real beautiful. I mean, even though it's just like kind of like rolling hills and flat brush, you know, brown brush, it's still just a really beautiful, beautiful, like peaceful area that... You know, you just really understand why these cowboys are out there doing what they do, because it's you're under the stars. It's peaceful. You don't have to deal with city folk or
no light pollution.
Mm-hmm. No light pollution. Nothing. You know, it's you and you know just a few of your buddies and horses. It's a pretty cool life.
Now, why did that connect with you?
Just you know, I don't know. I'm
will it.
Huh? Well, Willie, yeah, Willie, I mean,
that's what it sounds like to me, having that kind of like small town upbringing and being able to reconnect with that.
Americana.
Yep.
Yeah. That's a, you know, your experience with Willett and...
Willett's, yes.
Willett's. I'm sorry, Willett's.
It's not plural, but it's got an S.
Yeah, it's got an S. And, you know, it's Americana.
Yeah.
Yeah, to me.
And so it's good. It's just really cool to bring those little, you know, those... moments that people would never see. They hear about them, you know, they know about them, but they'll never see them.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So it's kind of like with me and doing these little documentaries, to me, it kind of feels like when I'm shooting concerts, the greatest feeling for me was like being able to get backstage, photographing the artists and the singers backstage, you know, and kind of bringing that aspect to their fans. Because, I mean, everybody can go online and see 1,000 people of them, you know, or 1,000 photos of them on stage.
Oh, right.
But being able to see those backstage moments, it kind of gives you that kind of like, holy shit, this is awesome. You know, these are facts. This is what they do, you know?
Yeah.
You know, rock and roll artists, you know, they're just like us.
They really are. Sometimes better or worse.
Yeah. So I really love capturing those photos and bringing those to my audience. You know, it's just the backstage and bringing them into that world that they don't have access to, like Jim Marshall, you know, shooting Jimmy and everybody, you know, everybody else, you know, and the Doors. I mean, it's a really cool feeling. And so being able to bring the small town to bigger America, I guess, is for me anyway, it's kind of like that same feeling, you know, it's bringing this to them, you know,
Where do you want to go with this? Like, are you stopping at this? Are you focusing on doing a trilogy, or do you want to do more parts and continue this just as a open-ended
project? It's just open-ended.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of where I'm going to focus more of my attention from here on out. You know, but thing, you know, life changes, things change, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'll still obviously hit the streets and everything, but for my bigger projects, it's going to be more documentary, more small towns and, you know, just wherever, you know, and I'm always kind of the person where I can go to any little town, go to the bar, come out with 100 friends at the end of the night. I've always been that, you know, that kind of person where, you know, you just kind of just talk to anybody. It just comes easy for me.
And which, I mean, you know, agree or not, the truth is when it comes to small town America, especially like where I grew up, which sounds like a lot like where you grew up, the bar is seriously the door, the entry into the place. I mean, depending on the city you're in, you might not find the best of people, or you might also find the best of people. Yeah. It just depends. Yeah. But it's where the most sharing, the most generous people are going to be. And, you know, alcohol notwithstanding.
Well, that determines if they're everybody.
Exactly. Yeah. They can go one of two ways. But it is a great entry into a town if you're looking at doing a documentary on said town or on the people of that town. Mm-hmm. So to our listeners out there, just a little food for thought.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and this kind of reminds me, although this show is not about Casper, but your documentary, the thing that you're getting ready to embark on with the Mississippi River thing, is it kind of reminds me. It's that part of America that's being lost.
Oh yeah,
yeah. It's disappearing. But
even if not necessarily disappearing, like the ranches and stuff, it's not like the industry is just going to evaporate tomorrow. It's still going to be there, you know, eternally to a point. But it's fading away from the national awareness.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
you don't think about ranches today. You know, in general society or urban society in particular, you don't think about the river industry, which brings your food to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or like you said, the ranches or the farms that bring the food to your table. It's things that are easily overlooked and ignored.
You make a great point because it's not that this stuff is going away. We're always going to need river transportation.
But it's still going to be needed.
We're always going to need the ranches, but with the urbanization of the culture, basically,
mm-hmm.
you kind of lose. You're right. You kind of lose that, and it's important to document that.
Yeah,
I really do. I really think so.
If for nothing else in posterity, but just understanding is a necessity, I believe, more so today than it has been in quite a while.
Right. Right. And I cannot wait to see what you come out with your Mississippi River project.
Mm-hmm. That would be great, but it's about CJ today.
I have seen what CJ has come out with so far, and man, I really enjoy it. I was really loving that stuff, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's it's just kind of one of those things that's kind of really dear to your heart, and I'm finally able to do it and just kind of take off with it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, there's no limit to this thing, and It just kind of inspires me every day. Just like, oh, you know what? Where do I want to go today or next week or whatever? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just going to pop in real quick to throw some love to our sponsor, Glass Key Photo. This is San Francisco's premier analog photography store and a staple for many photographers here in the Bay Area. If you're looking for analog gear, repairs, film, old or new, amazing zines by local artists, or simply want some great company and the opportunity for some fun photo walks, this is the place to be. You can find out more information and upcoming happenings by following them on Facebook or Twitter by searching Glass Key Photo or visit their website at glasskeyphoto.com. Now, after 5 years in the colorful and historic Haight District, they have relocated closer to downtown. You can now find them at 1230 Sutter Street. That's between Polk Street and Van Ness. It's a fantastic new venue offering a ton of space, breath of fresh air, I'm sure, for not only Gordon and Matt down there, but all photographers here in the Bay Area. Above all, while in San Francisco, be sure to visit Glass Key Photo and give a big hello from all of us here at Street PX. Segway travels. I know last year you went on one buku backpacking trip through, I'm going to say Europe, but were you limited to Europe? Did you go outside of Europe at the time?
I wanted to, but I wasn't able to.
No. So around mid or early 2016, you were doing some travels, which I definitely want to talk about, but it's the refugee camp.
Mm, yeah.
Was that kind of your primary intent on going overseas, or did you just end up there? Oh, it was.
No, that was my primary intent. Basically, I worked at, I was a contractor at Google for a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but I was putting together this European trip as well at the same time. And coincidentally, there were these refugee groups like IRAP, International Refugee Assistance Project. Wish they had a shorter name. I hate saying that, but anyway.
IRAP. Yeah, you IRAP.
So, yeah, they came and they did a speech at Google, you know, and I went to it. I was really inspired. I'm like, hey, you know, my name's CJ, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to Europe, you know, let's collaborate sort of thing. And they're like, okay, cool, you know, and they put me in touch with some different people and whatnot. And IRAP is a group of basically lawyers that they hear different refugee stories and they try to grant them asylum. You know, so
American based or international?
Well, they're based in New York.
Okay.
But I think they might have some offices over there.
So it's a tied in scenario.
Yeah. So anyway, they put me in touch with three different refugees, a gay man in Amsterdam that I hung out with and documented, just the nicest guy in the world. Another person in she was from Syria. She was like 19-year-old rapper, and she lives down in Grenoble, something like that.
Grenoble
in southern France. There,
yeah,
beautiful, beautiful little town that was like on the border of the like the French Alps there.
Skiing, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Skiing is good beautiful. At that place. Yeah.
Then there was another gentleman in Germany that was a translator for the military, but unfortunately I wasn't able to get to him. I really wanted to. I really would love to get that interview still. But so you know, I flew into Stockholm, cruised to Amsterdam, interviewed you know, the gentleman the next day, and yeah, I just really hit it off. He was just a really, really nice gentleman, really soft spoken, and he was just telling me about his life, about his hardships coming up, his boyfriend down there, they like poured oil on his back and lit him on fire.
Ooh.
I mean, it's mother really, really fuckers. Terrible what they, they do to people down there. And it's, yeah. And so
I think we lose sight of how violent things can truly be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a whole nother world, but so after that, I met up with some friends in Paris, and then I eventually cruised up to Calais, France. I worked up there for a week. I was working with this English group, Care for Calais, and just a really nice set of volunteers, mostly from England. I met somebody from Canada there and whatnot, and so that was like kind of my way in. That was my way in, not kind of, but because I didn't know. I've never been there. I don't know the scene. So, you know, I volunteered with this group, interviewed people, and then just cruised into Calais. And our job was basically to, we would get stuff from our warehouse, bring it out to the camp, you know, and then, you know, 6-7 of us would just pass it out to different refugees that were lining up in the back of the tent or the truck or the, you know, the box.
So this was the actual refugee camp.
Yeah.
Describe it. What was it like?
I mean, it was a big giant shanty town,
Okay.
It wasn't just Syrian refugees. It was different refugees from all over Africa, from the Middle East. I mean, there were over 30 different, groups there.
Uh-huh.
The women and the children, they were in separate camps, but sometimes you'd see them walking around in the male camp or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Cause unfortunately there was like, you know, rapings going on. There's some really bad things happening, you know, at nighttime and whatnot. So,
yeah.
So the conditions are pretty harsh.
It was pretty, pretty harsh. You know, I mean, there, when I got there, it used to be like twice as big, but they bulldozed the southern end of the camp. And, then there was only the northern part. And I think, I would say maybe about 5,000 people when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I left a couple months later, there was, they bulldoze the whole thing. So, I mean, everything is gone, but there's still refugees coming there because it's the shortest distance from there to England. So a lot of people are trying to like jump into the lorries, into the trucks, trying to, you know, stow away in there, trying to jump on the trains. But a lot of people die from that way, you know.
So the bulldozing is a manner to try and, are they attempting to remove the refugee camp, at least the country? And the people just keep coming, and it
exactly.
So it's a point of illegal immigration. Dude.
Oh yeah, big
that's,
time.
That's
you know,
basically why. Yeah.
And so they set up a little while ago. They set something up where you know these refugees, they moved them basically to different parts of France, but that entailed that they had to register. You know, mm-hmm. And a lot of immigrants didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
Excuse me, and so. They didn't want to register or anything. They just wanted to take their chances. So
yeah,
everything is just split, and it's just kind of a really bad situation.
Yeah. But,
when you were there, were there still individuals? I know that all of them were seeking asylum somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I know at the time, some countries are taking people in or not. Do you recall people being able to leave there, or was it just mostly arrival and just hope for the best?
They would. I mean, people could come and go as I wish.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like they. It's not like they, you know, couldn't go. They were like in jail there or anything. People could come.
No. I mean, as far as like trying to go to other countries, like America, we were accepting refugees, or Australia was accepting refugees, mm-hmm. or so forth. And I know that there's kind of a process in place. They have anything like that established there at the camp, or did they have to leave the camp to be able to do it?
The camp was a free for all.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't have anything. They, you know, before the Brexit thing, they were talking about, you know, taking the kids, the children, because I mean, there was children all around there riding their bikes around there, 10-year-old kids, you know, 9-year-old
kids. Significant population of children, huh?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Tons that came up there with other kids that made their way.
How would you, like, if you were to estimate the population of that 5,000, how many would you say were, like, women and children?
I don't know.
Children in particular, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how many women there were, because we never went over in that area. Children, I mean, God, I don't know, maybe over 100 or something.
Just from the male side that you were on.
From what I've seen, yeah.
Hmm, okay.
But, I mean, there could have been more, there could have been less. That's kind of...
Right, I was just curious to kind of give our listeners a vision.
But the people, I mean, even though it was just like a really bad shanty town, you know, just horrible living conditions, you know, there was like 4 or 5 people to just like a little box, like an 8x8 box.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were lucky, you were able to get like a camper van that was out there.
Yeah.
Just randomly. And, but these places, they had like some of the best food I've ever had in my life. Oh my God.
Isn't that always the case?
Hey, yeah. Food comes from the heart. Yeah. It doesn't come from money.
It was, I mean,
you'll need a tablecloth in
video. Yeah. They had some of the best food in these little places that were set up. You pay like $5 American, you know, whatever it is in euros, and it's just like you get so freaking much food. Yeah. It's just like the best. I'm like, I wanted to go there just for the food, you know. But it was cool, you know. And there were little shops. I always got Red Bulls every morning. Paid a couple bucks for a Red Bull.
Uh-huh. So did they have any like food? I mean, I know we were talking about food, but was there like any as far as food coming in? Water? Was there any troubles with that?
All
or sounds like
no. The only problems was the bathrooms were terrible, terrible situation. There was shit literally overflowing in these things.
Make truck stops look like 5-star hotels.
Oh, my God. Yeah, pretty much.
God damn it.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Oh,
I just wanted to put that image in people's heads.
Yeah, because I mean, we went from good food to that.
Well, the food's got to go somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
All right. Cleaning it.
I see the segue.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ, what name?
But that was pretty much the pretty terrible.
Now what kind of images were you getting out of this camp?
So images, it was kind of difficult to bust out my actual, you know, Leica to
photograph. I bet that was tricky.
Yeah, because I don't want to be sneaky, you know, and piss people off.
Yeah.
And, you know, because a lot of refugees, they don't want their face on any kind of social media or anything.
Yeah.
They don't want their photos anywhere because it kind of help, you know. You know, they don't know who's looking at this, and they could be identified. Like, you know, so they don't want that. So I would actually have to kind of break all my rules of being, you know, candid, and I'd have to ask, you know, like, hey, you know, kind of lift my camera up, like, can I get a photo sort of thing? And they'd be like, oh, okay, or no.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, you know. So I was, you know, had to be very respectful. So a lot of most of my shots were of buildings and living conditions, but I was able to get a few, you know, a few different shots of actual people and situations.
Cause I know you're into emotion and capturing emotion. Were you able to do that when you were with a few images of the people that you were
in? Yeah, like one of my images is this gentleman, right? This gentleman where it just really shows like the really bad living conditions that they're in, you know, water on the ground. The propane tanks, you know, just kind of lying around with a trailer and whatnot.
Uh-huh.
And he's just kind of sitting on a bench, his, you know, feet, you know, his feet and his arms, just, you know, everything just kind of really tightly wound up with his head into his arms and legs, you know,
it's
looking
like a fetal
down.
Position, but seated.
Yeah, exactly. And so that was one of my favorite shots. Well, it was my favorite shot that I got. And it just kind of... For me, it just really shows what these people do every, you know, have to go through every single day.
Uh-huh.
Now, from what I'm looking at, I'm seeing the water that's coming in. I'm just flooding.
Mm-hmm.
And this is right in front of this gentleman's shop, I'm assuming, yeah?
No, it's just... No,
it's just where he's
It's just at. A kind of area where... I think there was a... like a wash station on the right. Because they have like wash stations everywhere around there.
Yeah.
You know, just like makeshift sink, you know, elongated sinks where they do their laundry and where they get their water and stuff like that.
So, was it important to you to capture that emotion in
Oh, my camp? God, yeah. I needed, you know, I just needed something to just kind of encapsulate what... You know, just the atmosphere of that area was all about. And for me, that one sums it up perfectly.
Yeah.
You know, of what they have to deal with every single day.
Was there any individuals from the camp that you remember that kind of, you know, bored themselves into your memory?
Yeah. Actually, his name was Mohammed. A really, really nice guy. You know, like every night me and my friends, we'd go out to the bar, you know, and drink. And he would show up and like... I was there for 1 week and then I came back and I was there for another week. But the first week I was there, I mean, he was always hanging out and stuff. And I thought he was a volunteer. He spoke perfect English. He had like barely of an accent, but he spoke perfect English. He was wearing really, really nice clothes. So, you know, I'm just like, hey, you know, whatever, you're a volunteer. So you just assume. Volunteered. I just assume. He's like, no, I'm a refugee. I'm like, what the fuck? Really? He's like, yeah, man, I came from here. This is my story. I was like, oh, wow. And I would always see him and, you know, in the camp, and, you know, we'd always just talk and chat about little things. He'd ask me about America, and I'd ask him about his country and whatnot, and just a really, really nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he would just tell me about what he would do, you know, kind of like his daily routine. And it was kind of amazing because sometimes they would, there were these groups, these charter buses that would come out and actually bus refugees out to different places around France so they could actually see the culture. You know, and see different areas. So kind of free, like field trips, you know, so.
And that was all from within the camp that they would set these situations up, or was this external?
It was external.
Okay. Was UN or just the local government or privateers?
I think it was just privateers, just private.
I don't mean to go all piratey like privateers, I am assuming that's the word. It's just individuals.
Well, let me just clarify one thing. These people who were in the camps, were they there? Were they in the country legally?
No.
Everybody
was illegal.
Yes, everybody was illegal. So, but they were able to take them out to these camps and take them to these explorations without.
Yeah.
Worried about getting captured by whatever the French version of INS.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's actually a good point.
Yeah. They were all there. Even the French police, they were there as well too.
Okay.
In getting into that here in a second, but it was just people, privateers, volunteers, you know, just giving these people just kind of some shed of humanity to get them out of their these shitty ass conditions.
I mean, this looks like District 9.
Just basically letting people know, you know, we actually care about you.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So that was cool. But then, after that, I went around, I did my interview with the other lady, cruised around Europe and whatnot for about another 3 weeks. And then I came back, back to Calais. And when I got there, there was like a lot of like kind of civil unrest going on. Like the first day I was back, it was really, really foggy day, and Claire, who was like the kind of the leader of the who's in charge of Care for Calais, I was out there with her, and she's like, you know, get your camera out, whatnot. And what was going on was it was really, really foggy that day, and so a lot of the refugees were jumping the fence. They were kind of, they were trying to get into trucks, they were trying to get into cars, you know, they were trying to do anything they could to get it, you know, through the border. And
so using that fog as an advantage.
Exactly. And so the French police, who are always there, they came out and they started shooting little kids with like bean bags.
Okay.
They were gassing people, you know, trying to keep them
which
back.
Which that can be mortally, like that can kill people.
Yeah. I mean,
I know it's not intended to be, but it can.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so it was really, really fucked up what they were doing to these, you know, they were targeting little kids. And yeah, it was really bad. And like when I was going over, we had to take the back way this time, and I could just see like all the puffs of, you know, smoke of tear gas and everything. We finally parked and we all ran up there, and it was kind of at the tail end, and everybody was kind of peaceful, just, kind of facing off with each other. And if you look at my website, you know, you'll be able to see that, just kind of that face off with the little kids, with adults, with, you know, the French police and whatnot, which is crazy with the French police. I mean, yeah, they have a job to do. A lot of guys are dicks there, you know, because they're sick of these refugees and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, from going out and, you know, going out to the bars, and like we were just talking about, that's where you learn a lot about people. They, you know, 1 hour, you know, they're like, yeah, fuck these refugees and blah, blah, blah. And next thing you know, they're talking about, you know, a couple beers later, you know, they're just like, man, I hate what I do, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And I just, you know, just wish I didn't have to do this.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of like really
a flip. There's that regret.
Yeah, yeah. And so at first they look all tough, but then you get a few beers in them and they're just like, they just...
Poor.
Yeah. Wow. They're like, fuck, this sucks. I don't want to do this, but I have to.
There's so many narratives to follow in this whole thing.
It is.
Yeah, because you can look at it from the viewpoint of the refugees, from the viewpoint of the police.
From the civilians.
And from the viewpoint of the military. I mean, you had Marines in your background, so you have a perspective that is going to be different than a civilian.
Right.
You know, I mean, how did that play out for you as far as looking at the way that these people were treated, or at least the conditions that they were living in, while at the same time looking back on your history as a Marine, being somebody that fights to establish a better life and a better world for people?
I mean, it's...
At least that's the intention, of course.
Right, right. I mean, I just, I guess my military background came into it. It was more about protecting myself, you know, because you never know.
Well, that's the way
So it's more on the defensive.
It's primary.
And, and so sometimes people would get pissed off, and so you just have to be a little more defensive about things, but you have to show that, you know, you're kind of in charge, you know, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And like, because if you show fear, you show weakness, and people are just going to run all over
right,
you.
Right.
But I can see you can't do that.
But I can see the correlation between what you were just saying about the French police and getting a few beers in them and them admitting that guilt that they feel. I mean, I'm sure while you're in the military, you had situations that came up that afterward, or if we got a few beers into you, more than we already have. You know, these things, these human emotions are going to come up, and sometimes you have a job to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, fortunately for me, I was between wars, you know, so I never had to go over there and see that.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, so I didn't really get to experience any of that or anything, you know, whatnot. But, you know, I mean, I've always been, you know, I've always had a, you know, good head on my shoulders, you know, and for the most part anyway.
We all like to think that
Hold on, let me crack open another beer. But
Yes. The Stella is flowing.
These guys are imbibing. I'm the only teetotaler around here. We'll get something out of both of them. Yeah.
Don't let Jim fool you. He's already took back 3 shots of whiskey.
Yeah. Oh, man, what are you telling that for? The guy got to loosen up, doesn't he?
It's true. But
I've always had that like empathy for different groups and cultures of people and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the way that I was born, the way that I was brought up, and just having respect and not, you know, trying to learn and, you know, instead of just flipping off right off the bat about people that I don't know about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that's unfortunately what's happening a lot of times today, where people don't know anything, they see a word and they don't read something, you know, and so they just flip out, and people can't be that way.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be understanding of different groups and cultures. And
we're in a volatile era.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's the foundation of a good documentarian.
Yeah.
You know,
you have
empathy.
You have to separate.
Yeah.
Because if you get too vested, that's when the popping off can become very, very probable.
Yeah. Yep. So, I would like to go back.
I was going to ask, is it still active?
Yeah, I mean, there's still people in that area. I mean, there's a lot of kids going there. And then Brexit happened, and now that kind of screwed things up quite a bit, because now they're not taking anybody. But things could have changed since now and then.
Mm-hmm.
But last I heard, because of the Brexit, they're not taking any kids in. So a lot of people got screwed over that way. Jude Law, actually, he would come down to the camp sometimes.
Oh.
And he actually got to know one of the kids. And I think he adopted the kid, actually.
Really?
Got him out of there. And then I saw one of the guys from, what is it called? Black Eyed Peas. One of the guys from
there. Yeah.
He came out one day, and he was just kind of cruising around. It was the second time he came out, and he was just kind of learning more and more about him. And the people, Claire, who was in charge of Care for Kelly, she was touring him around, and then, like, he was literally standing next to me, you know, just talking about, you know, learning about. And it was kind of funny because, like, these refugees, they totally know who they are. You know.
So the thing about American culture somehow it spreads elsewhere. Yeah.
And so as soon as he walked by, everybody got their cameras out and they got their selfies and whatnot. And that's another thing, you know. And, well, he, I'm like, hey, man, you want to help us give out clothes, you know? He's, and he just looked at me like, the hell? Why would I do that, you know? I was like... Yeah,
philanthropy only goes so far.
Well, hey, still money still goes a long way.
So, anyway, he God, I wish I could remember his name.
I was thinking Will I Am, but that
Will I Am.
That's
from the Fugees.
That's yeah,
from the Fugees.
Oh, the Fugees.
Yeah.
What did I say? Black
Eyed Peas. You said Black Eyed Peas.
Yeah.
He's from the Fugees.
No, Will I Am.
I'm thinking Wycliffe Jean.
You were thinking Wycliffe Jean.
Yeah, you're right.
Like so, Will I Am.
So, Will I Am came out, and he was just kind of touring around, checking things out and whatnot. And then it just got a little too crazy because all the refugees just bombarded. Like, hundreds of people just came out and just got selfies with him and, you know, whatever. And,
yeah.
He just. They brought the limo, or I mean, not the limo, but the truck up. And no limo, but he got out of there because it was getting a little too crazy.
Yeah. Well, it can also be dangerous,
too. And then we had to close up the truck that we were giving clothes out of because, you know, there was a good case that they could just bum rush you and just start grabbing and going, you know. So we didn't want to deal with anything. We just locked everything up. And
so with good intentions, Will I Am came in and fucked everything.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I'm just joking, but at the same time, truthful.
Yeah.
It's the nature of celebrity.
Exactly. So that was, I don't know, that was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would like to go back sometime and, you know, just kind of see how it's changed and whatnot, and just kind of interview people and kind of see what they think, you know, now that it's kind of dimmed down or, you know, simmered down now, but it's still, there's still an influx of people coming in.
Well, no, in previous episodes, I'm not sure which episode it is, but we'll put it into the show notes. We had an interview with Wasim Albadri. I think sometime last year, who was a refugee. He originated from a refugee camp, dealt with very similar conditions as to what you were just talking about. I remember his story of acquiring a camera by trading out some button-up shirts and maybe a pair of pants or something, but he had no film, and he was just running around shooting. So, I mean, but having that type of interest in documenting the situation, that's if for our listeners out there, if you go to CJ's website, which we'll bring up again here in a moment, he's got these images from the camp, and there's a sense of reality is the only word I can really think of that emanates from these images. And I don't think that you can really, I mean, obviously we can't understand or fathom that type of a situation without being there, but these images definitely help build that narrative. And I definitely recommend anybody out there to go take a look at this.
That's what I liked about what you said—the sense of place that these images gave you.
Yes,
you know, it's just that's the basis of a great narrative.
But now, coming off of the refugee camp, that was kind of like the preemptive start of your travels in Europe. It looks like you continued to travel Budapest and
Rome,
and some other. Yeah, like how long did you get? Was it just kind of like staying for a day in each of these places, or were you just training through?
It was a couple of days. So yeah, I mean, it was just trying to hit as many places I wanted to, you know, that I could and whatnot. I stayed like a week in Budapest, but unfortunately it was raining half the time that I was there. So
of course it would be.
Yeah. Could only do so much. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's like the city that I always really wanted to go check out. But yeah, I was able to explore quite a bit there and definitely would like to go back. But yeah, the rest of the trip was more about street photography. And, you know, whatnot. And so, I mean, it just, I like to go back and hit places that, where there's not like a million and one tourists, you know, it's just, you know, it's my second time over there and my first time that I was able to travel around. So I just wanted to hit the spots that I always wanted to hit.
Yeah.
You know, Venice was beautiful. I really loved photographing in Venice.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And just, you know, I used to be a bartender and God, this bar that I wandered into one night, they just... I don't know. They let me behind the bar, and I started slinging drinks.
Wait, it wasn't the famous bar, was it?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. It was just dive bar.
Yeah, it was just some random dive bar, you know. And I said, like, yeah, I'm a bartender. I'm a photographer, blah, blah, blah. And you know how one thing leads to another.
So you pretty much Bill Murray'd the situation. Just, like, showed up and was like, let me, I got this.
Yeah, pretty much. I got photos, you know, thank God, because I was like, yeah. And yeah,
that's fantastic.
Thank God my host let me stay there till 7 that night, because the next day, because I was dying. I was freaking dying.
I know Venice can be overrun with tourists, but you can find some great times, especially if you're staying on the island, or if you can just after hours. Man, it's just fascinating.
Mm-hmm. How were you doing that? Street photography. Were you staying with people that you knew, or did they have like an Airbnb type of service?
I was Airbnb-ing it the whole time.
Yeah. So it's like legitimately Airbnb, but there.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was just Airbnb the whole time I was in Europe, except the last time that I went to Calais. First time I went there, I was staying in a hostel. I don't recommend that place. It was disgusting. And
yeah, there's movies based on that.
Yeah. And then the second time, I had enough points where I could, like, hotel points, and I stayed at the Holiday Inn, which is,
swanky.
A little bit better. Yeah. Not by much, but, you know, it was much better. I didn't have, random pieces of hair on my pillow, you know.
roaches posing for you.
You know,
like, that's your friend sometimes. But so the Airbnb was kind of your main ticket.
You know, and you meet really, really nice people and whatnot. Everybody's super kind.
That's the thing that when you travel, you don't really think about that aspect, but there's that social structure to it of being able to meet people who, I mean, everybody's kind of the same everywhere with mild differences. And I mean, as long as you're moderately outgoing person, grab yourself a Euro pass, you know, dial into the Airbnb app and just rock on.
You know, back before, because I went to Europe before Airbnb existed. So you would, when I did that, I would be on a train, go to a train station, see who was renting rooms and do that.
Couch surfing.
Couch surfing type thing. And it was fantastic. You got to meet so many people. They would tell you where to go.
You learn so much. We could buy, there's always that kind of that adage, don't buy gear, buy plane tickets or what have you. Definitely swear by that. We could spend $1,500 on a new camera, but honestly, if the camera you already have is working, fuck that. Don't buy a plane ticket and just $15, $20, $50, you know, whatever it is to stay somewhere and just roll through a country. And learn about the people, talk to the people.
Definitely.
I know in street we always talk about don't interact and stuff, and that's for the shot.
That's
different than getting to learn about a culture and opening up your horizons.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it's so I totally missed a beautiful opportunity to do some great street shooting and family shooting when I went to Istanbul. And these people were inviting me into their homes to talk to them, just sitting down and talk to them about America, about whatever. And now I think, God, the shots I could have gotten, because these people were totally down for getting their photos taken.
Yeah.
You know, they were totally down for it. But at the time, I wasn't doing that. You know, I really wasn't into that.
Hindsight is a bitch.
You're right. So, what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they were doing in the refugee camp when I was there. These little 15-year-old kids were inviting me and my friends into their trailers, and they wanted to know about America. What was it like, you know, or where, you know, what was it like in England with the people with me? I was listening to their stories because they wanted to go to, they really wanted to go to school, but the Taliban was preventing them to go to school. You know, they wanted to be engineers and this and that. And so by the power of Facebook, you know, that's how him and his roommate, whatever, that they're friends now, that's how they met. And over Facebook, there's like a closed group or something where, you know, who's going to make the trek to France and blah, blah, blah. So somehow they met in the middle, and they trekked their way up with everybody else to France, you know. And they left their family behind, and this and that's this thing about like what we see is only what the media tells us,
right?
You know, and depending on unless you've been there, then
it's a narrow field of view.
Exactly, they have no idea what's going on. They just put everybody as a whole in the same basket, which is bullshit. You know, yeah. These people, all they wanted to do was go home, see their family.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have a home to go to anymore. You yeah. know, and so it's they have to do the next best thing for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is migrate to a different country.
Yeah.
You know, to family members, live with family members.
Most people can't relate to that. Mm-hmm. Like, it's easy to see on the news and hear, you know, mainstream media talk about refugee camps in a...
Well, in the yeah. context of illegal immigration or whatever. That, yeah, you know, the, yeah, that's what I mean. Everything is thrown into that bowl.
Yeah,
you know?
It's just all in the yeah. same base, yeah. but it is, right. it's so mm-hmm. convoluted and right. complex.
Right.
And whenever you consider the fact that, you know, you don't have a home. You don't have a, like, not just a house. I'm not talking about a house or land or any of that bullshit. I'm talking about a country.
Yeah.
You don't have anywhere to go.
No.
And you can't just, like, box everybody together, like, with a couple of extremists and then an entire population right. with it.
Yeah.
Because these are human beings.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same thing here. You know, I went to go photograph the Ann Coulter rally over in Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yeah, that's one of the things. I mean, I love photojournalism. You know, it's what I would have loved to be doing, but unfortunately, it's, you know, nothing's paying right now.
Yeah,
right. Everything is saturated. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, so I'm just do what I do. Hopefully, get my work gets kind of noticed, and it has.
Yep.
Yeah. And so, when I went and shot that rally, I mean, it's just so crazy seeing just kind of like both sides, how the tension in the air was just so thick. I mean, I was there chatting with like Nazis and people with like Hitler tattoos and swastikas on their arm.
Uh-huh.
You know, the only reason they would chat with me is because I wore my shirt, you know, that had a Marine Corps emblem on there.
Okay.
So it was kind of my little spy, you know, being spying, you know. Kind of my get out of jail free card and whatnot. Yeah, you know? And
they probably would kick my little butt, wouldn't they?
I mean, but having to, like we were just chatting about, having to separate yourself from your own emotions and your ideals and whatnot. You know,
uh-huh.
I wanted to chat with them. I wanted to see why they were here and what was going on. You know, I wanted to do this and that. And it was kind of funny because when I was speaking to the wife of one of them, and she was talking to me like in a way that she shouldn't have been talking to me, you know. She was like, oh, yeah, you know, so, oh, you're in the Marine Corps? Oh, okay. You know, kind of standoffish, but the more we spoke and the more I kind of engaged, the more she kind of
opened up
a little more, you know. But it was like, my husband's looking at me right now. I can't talk to you, but I'm talking to you. Even though he was like, from me to you.
Yeah.
He was
yeah.
listening to the whole conversation.
So she was approaching it with heavy fear in a way.
Yeah, you know, yeah. And it was just, I found that aspect more interesting than just chatting with these guys.
Right.
Yeah.
Just yeah. seeing the body language and yeah. the way that they're approaching it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and like, just this giant person of a man, you know, I'm like, hey, would you mind if I got your shot? You know, the guy with all the tats. He's like, yeah, I would mind, man. Sorry. I'm like, cool. All right. Uh-huh. You know, and that was it. You know, I didn't.
Yeah.
He might be in the background of a few of my shots, but I don't want to start trouble or anything.
No,
you
no,
know
right,
what I
mean? Right. No. But they don't have their hoods, so.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, like, you know, I was there with Dwayne and everything, and, you know, there were some nice people that I met, you know, but at the same time, there was not everybody. I'm not going to pigeonhole everybody
no.
like that. You know, yeah, no, of course, but. There was a lot of people like that. A lot of people came to fight. A lot of people were ready for battle in like full-on uh-huh. combat gear and stuff. But
yeah.
a lot of people were there because, you know, because they're you know, conservatives. The thing is, you know, a lot of that conservativeness is kind of going a different direction now mm-hmm. with this whole, even liberals going, you know, I mean, going to the right, going to the left, you know, there's a lot of extremists happening right now. And mm-hmm. personally, my point of view, both sides like that are just jackasses. You know, I mean, it's just bad. I just watched this piece my friend posted the other day where this black man who's been hanging out and interviewing the people from the KKK for the last 30 years.
Right.
And he's changed a lot of people's mentality to, you know, take the robe off. And mm-hmm. he has. And it's, yeah, I think that's the way to do it personally, you know.
Yeah.
Engage with your quote unquote enemy or you yeah. know, that type, you know,
right.
learn about them.
It's a sort of diplomacy, you know? In a way,
yeah,
like
exactly.
to try and unmask.
Yeah, have respect to, you know, have a respect for kind of like, I'm not saying respect what they feel,
mm-mm, no, right,
but I'm just saying have the respect for something that they think is important to them, where they will, where you will get that respect in return, to see, you know, from them, like, this is how I feel. You know, mm-hmm. meet in the middle somehow.
Well, somewhere. It's like the Vice thing, the Vice video that came out recently. Mm-hmm. And we're in Charlottesville.
Yeah.
And Elle, unfortunately, I can't remember her last name right now, but she was the correspondent that was involved. And that's what she did. She, you don't let your feelings and your emotions and your comments, you know, come out.
Biases.
Yeah. Whenever you're documenting something like this, you have to come at it completely neutral, regardless of what your feelings are, because the moment that you announce whatever your feelings are, either a wall is going to happen.
Right.
It's just the nature of it.
You're going to lose all your credibility.
Every bit of it. And regardless of how legitimate that credibility is, it's not relevant in that moment.
Right.
You're trying to get this story and trying to shine a light on whatever Cervantes-like monster that you're dealing with, if that is the case, whatever your project is. But by holding and withholding that opinion, you can gain a lot more access.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if your intention is to be able to show something that is ugly or evil or whatever the opinion is, leave the opinion at home, show what it is, and then go home and scream in a mirror.
Yeah.
You know, but the main thing is create the project, create the video or photography, show it to the world, and then be angry.
Journalism 101.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what it is.
So, yeah, with journalists, you really do have to stay neutral with that.
And yeah.
It's tough. You know, I wanted to knock out a lot of people.
I bet you Dwayne wanted to, too.
Yeah.
Dwayne Newton, who was up as guest of the show earlier.
Yes.
But, you know, and...
And I could picture the two of you dotting many eyes.
Yeah. And I was watching Dwayne, you know, there was a group of some kids, and then another, you know, the
supremacists.
Yeah. They were kind of going at it, and Dwayne previously was chatting with one of them, and the guy who's being vocal to this group, he was getting ready to go into the military, into the army, to be a warrant officer. After the match, you know, Dwayne went up to him and was like, "Hey, man, you can't be doing that, because the military is going to see this. They're going to see photos. They're going to see you yelling. So unless you don't want to go into the military, you know, then keep your mouth shut, basically."
Yeah.
And he's like, "You know what? You're right.
Yeah.
You're right." And he didn't pipe off after that.
Yeah.
But one of my next projects that I want to do is actually get back with my old unit in the Marine Corps.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah.
Oh, hell yeah.
Working with a third. I was Amtracker, basically, in amphibious tanks. I was a crew chief on one of those. Excuse me. And, you know, I really want to go back down to San Diego, kind of get to see how the base has changed, see how everything has changed. Try to get out to the field with them and just kind of just do a little mini doc on them.
Now, when were you in the military? What years?
I went in April 95 and got out July 99.
It'd be interesting to see not only how the equipment has changed, but how the people have changed.
Yeah.
That would be something interesting.
Yeah,
the new recruits, what these people are like now, how they're different from when you were back in the, you know, especially the change with, you know, with the politics.
Yeah.
With the politics. Yeah, that'd be interesting.
So, I really wanted to kind of embed with them, you know, and go to the field, see what, you know, and just kind of see how things change, get to know, you know, some of the Marines and whatnot. And,
document the training corps, kind of see how that's maybe changed, because it's been, 95, that's looking at 2 decades ago, man.
Yeah.
You old.
Jesus Christ. Look at your ass.
You're old, man.
You're older.
Damn.
Oh shit! Remember, man. Jurassic Park came out 2 decades ago.
Yeah, yeah. That's true.
Yeah,
that's
true. Before we jump into that kind of last question, I definitely want to give a little boost here. What we're doing is we're looking at a magazine that CJ was just recently featured in, and before I fuck up the name and all of that stuff, I'm going to let him kind of talk about this. So you were recently featured in, what is this called?
Well, the first one was, it's called Et Cetera Magazine, City College of, you know, it's a city college at SF, their magazine. It was when Jane Kim and Bernie came to town and everything. And I just kind of snuck in with the help of somebody else. I was in my journalism class that I unfortunately had to drop like a month before that. jumped right in there, said I was like a journalist for the paper or whatever, you know, just kind of sneaking my way into things like I always do. And I was able to get a really cool shot. My showed the guy that I was working with that was in my class. He was the editor for Cetera magazine. And he really liked my shot. I got a call randomly out of the blue from my old teacher, and she's like, "Hey, we want to feature this shot of Jane Kim holding up the you know, the City College free tuition tab or whatever on the front. You know, we want to give you the cover." I was like, "Dude, hell yeah!"
Yeah.
Here's my work, and it's funny because she always would say like, you know, always, you know, ask for money because, you know, you're not going to get paid with recommendations, you know. So I'm like, okay, here's the cover, here's the photo, you know, go ahead and use it. You know, how much are you going to pay me? And, you know, that was, I don't know, when was that? Back in like the fall 2016. I'm still waiting for my check. So
Of course. Yeah. That's the life of a photographer, always waiting.
Always waiting, yeah. You know. But so the Summer of Love was, you know, still going on. And I was photographing this thing over in the Haight called The Thing, where me and my friends, we would all get together once a month on a Monday, and they would we would chat about, I mean not chat, but we would there would always be a theme for that following month on you know just some random theme. Unlikely friendship was one of the themes, you know, and so somebody would write a song about that. And it was kind of like an open mic sort of thing, but we'd have, you know, 10 whatever presenters that would sing a song or speak about a poem or something. And, you know, I would just kind of go around and photograph that. One day, randomly, like I was going around photographing, I was showing this guy who just happened to be standing there for like the week because he was here from New York working for a Dutch magazine called De Volkskrant, which means the People's Paper. And he really liked my work. He showed his editor my photography. She really liked it, and they commissioned me for a Summer of Love article. So, you know, a lot of them I already had, and luckily that was the
street photo.
Street photo weekend and everything. So I just cruised around and got a bunch of shots from the Haight Street Fair, which awesomely was going on. Sent those all in. They loved them. You know, paid me a good amount.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I got like 13 pages or 13 photos or so in this magazine, you know, in Amsterdam. And it just really brought together with the summer love. Yeah, I mean, a lot of them were cheesy, you know. cheesy, like, kind of photos and stuff that, you know, but they were like the stereotypical Haight Street summer love photos. Right. But, you know, it's just like they like to see that.
Yeah. You know? And especially, I mean, you're looking at something from the outside looking in.
Mm-hmm.
So... Yeah, and then what is it, like a 2 or 3 page spread?
Yeah, so yeah, it was cool. I was really happy with that. They turned out well, and you know, it's really cool to see a lot of my friends in this magazine.
Yeah, so not only are you a big deal in the United States, but you're overseas too.
International.
Yeah, international. So yeah, Calais, Amsterdam, where else, man?
Budapest.
Well, coming off kind of the international subject, Jim, you want to throw that last question that we always give our guests?
Well, let's talk about this now. Quick question. If you had a choice of shooting anywhere at any time, any particular time, since the inception of the camera, where would that place and time be?
Man, I know. I mean, I've talked about with Casper, you know, like about, you know, 50s, like 40s, 50s, kind of that time era. But, you know, I've just been thinking about this last couple days, you know. I mean, I don't know, man. It's 50s would be great for me just because, you know, late 40s, 50s, because it was like that post-World War II era. Mm. And World War II is my favorite era, you know.
World War II is your favorite, huh?
Yeah. I mean, you know.
No, I'm saying that's the same thing I said. I said post-war Europe.
He said post-war Europe. Yeah, same era.
Yeah.
But what area?
What's that?
Like what area of the world?
Probably New York. I mean, just because it's kind of the hub of the world, you know, almost.
Yeah.
Definitely the United States.
Uh-huh.
It'd be a little dangerous, though.
Well, you know, I mean, if I was, you know, if I were able to go back in time and do that with what I know now, you know, then definitely. Yeah. But I've never really shied away from those really kind of hostile areas or anything. I've never been like that in my life, even before the military.
Yeah.
You know, it's just with education comes a way in, I guess. You know, you just have to, you know, sometimes fake it or educate yourself. But yeah, 1950s, late 40s, just what the world was changing, you know, how the world was changing.
You're looking at the industrial
world was, and the industrial revolution, you know, baby boomers.
Yep. Yeah.
I mean, it was just, it was a crazy time, you know, what was happening and whatnot.
Post-Depression. There's a lot to go around.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know,
it's easy to forget how much happened in a 15-year span.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The whole world changed. I mean, you know, the United States became a world power. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, and the growing pains with that came with that. I mean,
It's like Act Three start.
I mean, it's a great thing to photo. It's kind of like I said, I liked the, you know, post-war Europe because they were rebuilding, they were changing, they were rebuilding.
Everything was fucking destroyed.
So you see people going about their business, you know, but with the backdrop of these destroyed, you know, basically a destroyed city, but they're still trying to go about their business. I would love to try to capture that, and it's. And it's pretty much in your way, you know, you want to do the United States. There's a different aspect. I mean, you know, they're becoming a world power. You know what we're becoming a world. God, have I disassociated with the U.S. government?
funny in these times, right? Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. You know, but it's becoming a world. Things are changing. Yeah. You know, and they're growing pains with that, and there'll be some interesting photography with that. Yeah.
Yeah, and just I guess the military side of me, rather than the civilian side. I mean, if I knew I was going to live through it, would be definitely like Vietnam.
Yeah.
Oh,
just,
yeah.
You know,
oh, yeah.
Just what was happening there. You know, I mean, I've done a lot of research about Vietnam, about mainly snipers, you know, that was happening. You know, the tunnels of Coochie that were being dug there. I mean, we had our Bob Hope here, you know, during Vietnam and whatnot. And it was crazy because, like, the Vietnamese, they had their Bob Hope. And so anytime, you know, we would bomb them. There's this big crater, and a lot of the times these tunnels would actually come into a crater. And these, the Vietnamese, like, entertainer, Bob Hope, they would do his shows in these craters.
Huh.
You know?
For real?
For real.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's brain surgeons that were using homemade drills to do brain surgery, you know, in tunnels. I mean, these tunnels were over, like, 300 miles, just this huge, huge network.
Conglomeration network. Yeah.
But... I would, you know, love to be able to photograph those, you know, what the troops were going through, the army, the military, everybody, you know, were going through those hard times.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just a whole different, like, obviously time in our era, but I mean, it was like, you know, we were so used to winning wars up until Vietnam.
Right.
You know, and we just got bitch slapped.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, most of our troops died because of booby traps.
Yeah,
not gunfire. It would average
falling in a bamboo pit.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the average amount of rounds that it took to kill one person was over 200,000 rounds.
Wow.
You know, I mean, it's so a lot of frustration. A lot of really dark days there.
The setting on the theater changed.
Yeah, I was gonna say you must be a fan of Eddie Adams. Yeah.
I've heard the name. I'm just not familiar with the work.
Oh, okay. Anyway. He's the guy that had the guy. The guy was shooting the Viet Cong
in the street.
Yeah, and actually with that shot, the bullet was actually inside the guy's head in that photograph.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I think the captain or the corporal, whoever, the guy that pulled the trigger.
He was a general.
Colonel,
I think, maybe at the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, he moved to New York and people found out who he was and they were scrolling on his little shop. They're like, we know who you are. You're going to die.
He's somewhere in like Montana. Well, he eventually lived out his life in like somewhere in the deep west.
Mm.
I got a chance to meet Eddie Adams one time.
Oh,
did you really?
At the Apple Store in Chicago.
He came make
a he made a presentation there with another photographer. I cannot remember who it was, but there were two famous photographers. They came and I got the chance to meet him. And then a couple of years later, he died.
Well, cool. Well, from that, let's go ahead and let the people out there know where we can find more pictures, more information about you.
All right. So my website, again, is C. Lucero Photos, and that's my last name is spelled L-U-C-E-R-O. So C. Lucero Photos. And I would love it if more people followed me on Instagram. You know, it's just more inspiration. But that one is at Range Grinder. Again, at Range Grinder. It's where I post most of my work, you know, every day. And I'm, you know, very active on there.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah.
Cool. All right, Jim.
I'm at jimwatkinsphoto.com, and all of my social media platforms are linked right to it.
Good deal. And you can find out more information about me at recasper.com. That's any of my blog posts, any of my current projects, workshops, things of that nature. But most importantly, go to streetpx.com. That's where you're going to find all of our past episodes. And we're actually closing in on 50 episodes.
Yay.
Believe it or not.
I wonder who's going to be the 50th.
TikTok.
Party, man.
You might have to. Oh, man. But yeah, go take a look at streetpx.com. Also, take a look at patreon.com. This episode actually will have bonus content, so you definitely would be very advantageous to be a Patreon contributor, because you get access to all bonus content. Depending on the tier that you choose, you can get photo reviews directly from Jim, myself, or any of our guests following an episode, free prints, a number of different things. But you can give $1, you can give $5, whatever you feel comfortable for. Everything that we receive goes back into keeping the bandwidth flowing on Street PX. Additionally, we like reviews. We love feedback. So let us know. Send us an email at contact@streetpx.com, or search us out on iTunes, Google Play Music, iHeartRadio, and throw us a review. We want those. We need those. That helps us get into more ears. So that said, I want to give a big thank you to all of you out there listening, and a big thank you to CJ for taking the time to talk with
us. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Man.
Yeah, excellent. And here soon, we will talk to you in 2 weeks. All right. Happy trails, and don't freak out because of the eclipse next week. Or this eclipse that just happened. Who knows? I forgot. Fuck it.
Bye. Time warp. Bye.